Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Really, 007.
Welcome to the Really 007 podcast for this special behind-the-camera interview with Oscar winner Norman Wanstall, who is here with us today. So it's lovely to see Norman. Now, Norman's had an amazing career in sound editing. He worked on all of Sean Connery's James Bond films. So yes, that includes Never Say Never Again,
yes,
which he came out of retirement for, all the way back from where Bond started in 1962. So one of the original greats who made the series. So incredible to just be in his company. Now, we do have other interviews you can watch on our YouTube channel. Just go to Really007Pod. at YouTube. We're also on iTunes and Spotify and all social media channels such as Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, where you can follow us and interact with Bond fans from all over the world. Now, I'm Tom Pickup and I've got my friend John Kell here with me today. And we're fascinated to hear more about the world of sound editing, the world of editing.
Sure.
Because a lot of people, you know, would sort of know that these jobs exist, but they don't know how to create the sounds. They don't know what's involved, the editing process. So I don't know, Norman. Could you sort of explain what it is to be, first of all, a sound editor? What does that job entail?
Yes. Basically, most people, if ever I give a talk, I always take with me a roll of film and a roll of sound, because most people don't actually take in the fact that the sound and picture are totally separate. And that's very, very important, because it means that if you went onto a film set and you see the camera crew lining up the shot, you know, way over the other side, there would be the sound man there with his tapes. And in the evening, the negative that they shot all day would go off to the laboratory. The tapes would go into the sound department. The following morning, the film would come back on 35 and the sound would come back on 35. They'd put those tapes onto 35mm stock. So now you've got these two rolls of film that will go together now all the way through the making of the film. If you go into a viewing theatre, picture goes on the projector, sound goes on a sound machine, switch, and the two start to roll. Which means that the soundtrack is completely available for people that want to decide whether or not which parts of the soundtrack are worthy of the final film and which really aren't, and they will have to be replaced. So what happens is, at the end of shooting, there's no point before the end of shooting, at the end of shooting, on a film the size of Bond, you would bring on two sound effects editors, or they're called dubbing editors. Now, there are some films which are very talky pictures indoors. You don't need two. One guy could cope, or one girl could cope with it all. But on Bond films, of course, there's so much going on. So what we used to do was to have one editor, sound editor, that would only deal with the dialogue. They would bring the actors back into a recording theatre for lines that weren't suitable or weren't worthy, and they would re-record the dialogue with the actor until it was in sync. whereas the sound effects editor would only concentrate on all the guns and the cars and the helicopters and the special noises and things like that. And that's those two are always in touch, but they work very, very independently. And the only reason I was given the chance to do this job, which was quite remarkable, really, was, as you probably know, that Dr. No's budget was so ridiculous that everybody looks back now and thinks, how did they make that film for $1.5 million?
Yeah, unbelievable.
With those incredible sets. No, Ken Adam, how he did. But anyway, cut a long story short, Peter Hunt said, Norman, I'm awfully sorry, mate, but we can't afford two sound editors. You worked on three major pictures with one of the finest sound editors in the country. I know you've never done any sound editing, but we're going to have to make you the effects sound effects editor, and we will bring on someone to do the dialogue. And so from then on, I went into my own room with my own assistant, and I had to just copy what I learned from the man that I worked with before.
Yeah. So who's the chap you learnt from then?
His name was Winston Ryder.
Right.
His credits were incredible. Bridge on the River Choir, Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
The interesting thing is he never ever called me across and said, Norman, look, this is the way you... He never once did that on three major films. But I used to watch what he did and I learned the actual principles of how he took on a major film. And of course, the third film that we worked on was Sink the Bismarck, which was edited by Peter Hunt.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
The rest is history.
Is that how you got to know Peter Hunt through that film?
Yes, it was.
Oh.
Yes, because we're all working as a team, even though I wasn't on his side of it. And towards the end of the picture, I realised that his assistant was going to move on to a job in London. And I thought, wow, what a chance to get back to film editing rather than sound. So I approached him and he said, fine, that'll be great. I felt rather sorry letting Wynne down, but I think he realised that, you know, that's the way it works.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how was Peter? What was he like as a gentleman?
Peter and I became a really, really strong team. We were like, you know, father and son, really.
Oh, right.
And we worked on about four major features before he was lucky enough to be given Dr. No.
Yeah.
And I respected him greatly and he respected me. I mean, I was a young single guy. When he went home, I'd stay behind and make sure everything was put back the way it was. We were a really, really good team. The fact that he had the confidence to give me Dr. No proves it all, really.
Yeah.
He's one of the people we see as one of the great starting blocks of Bond.
Absolutely.
So you have him, you have Ken Adam, Terence Young, John Barry, and these people have... It's a shame almost that at some point they have to leave the franchise and move on. When you started on Dr. No, could you sort of tell us how you came to be chosen? Was it Peter just recommending you? Was that how it was done?
No. We were a team. I had assisted him. I was now his assistant.
Ah. Yes.
We had two assistants. I was his first assistant, then we had another guy who was the second assistant. And the second assistant's the one that synchronises all the rushes every morning because, you know, these two roles arrive and you don't know where they sink. I assisted him for, I'm sure it was four films before Dr. No arose. And so we automatically went on it together.
Right.
And I remember him saying to me when he started to see the rushes, he said, Norman, I think the only way we're going to make this film really work is we've got to keep it moving. We've got to make it moving so fast. No one stops to analyse anything. Let's keep it moving. And so he established that style of editing.
Yeah, yeah.
Any chance he had of moving slightly quicker, getting someone through a door a little bit faster, he did it. And I think every editor from then on followed that pattern, followed that style of editing.
John Glenn's told us that. He learnt a lot through Peter Hunt.
Ah,
and of course, he brought him in for Honor Majesty's. So it's like a family that develops, isn't it?
That's right.
They keep going.
That's right.
It's like a culture, isn't it? That's like being bred through it. It's so good.
And when I think he began to feel that they were going to give him a chance to direct, I feel that because we reached the point where I noticed he was spending more time on the set. And so he used to say to me, look, Norman, you can assemble the film, which was like... you assemble that scene and I'll be on the set, I'll come back. He used to say that assembling a film wasn't really what he wanted to do. He liked the fine cutting, you know, that last little frame here. So for the very first time, I had a chance to actually feel what it was like to sit on a moviola and cut shots together. I learned a lot from that. So that was invaluable for me when I eventually got my chance.
My word. You'd already worked, hadn't you, with Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli on those earlier pictures. Was the Call Me Buana.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot Call Me Buana.
Yeah.
That was after Dr. No, though, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Was
yeah.
it after? Because
okay. the poster was on the front.
Yes,
it was on one.
Yeah, so, I'm pretty certain it was.
Yeah.
Quick, he's coming.
That pays many debts.
She should have kept her mouth shut.
Yeah, it was just like a team, really, wasn't it? The same people worked on the same films. And people always ask me what I thought about the two men, but because we were backroom people, I never really had much chance to get to know either of them, to be honest.
Yeah.
I got the feeling that Cubby was like the father figure, whereas Harry was more of, you know, into himself. You couldn't really track that.
So how much interaction did you have with the set and that kind of thing?
Virtually none at all.
No. So it was all, you saw all the footage for the first time when it was coming in and you heard
each day, the rushes.
The rushes.
It was always a nice thing about the rushes is that the whole crew plus us all came together in a theatre to watch yesterday's filming. And it was a very nice feeling, you know.
Yeah.
I used to enjoy that.
So that was Pinewood, wasn't it?
Pinewood.
This was, yeah.
Yeah.
So just tell us, going back to the beginning, how did you get involved in the industry? It was at Pinewood, wasn't it?
It was, yes. It was pure luck, really, because I went to a co-educational school and there was a girl there I became sort of friendly with, and her mother had a very big job at Pinewood. She was the assistant to the production controller. That was her title. And she said to her daughter one day, she said, look, school holidays are coming up. Get a couple of friends and I'll take the three of you around the studio
That's
for a day.
Amazing.
And I was one of those friends. And of course, for a 14-year-old boy to go 14? Around a film studio, I mean, we were passionate about film. We didn't have television and stuff like that. Saturday mornings, they laid on films purely for youngsters, Saturday morning pictures. We love film. And that day stayed in my brain forever because not only did I absorb the atmosphere of walking down the corridor with film stars going by and all these photographs on the wall and the women were so coolly dressed, you know, in trousers and things around their neck. But the highlight, I don't know if you've ever stood outside a film studio, but what makes it different from any other factory are these massive rectangular buildings called stages.
Yeah.
They are absolutely huge. There's no windows, rectangular, absolutely enormous, and probably it would have stage A, stage B, or stage one, stage two. And when you go inside, they're completely empty, apart from the fact that when you look up, there are all these strips going across which are for holding the lights. And she took us onto one of these because normally there's a thing on the wall saying forbidden to enter, you know, because you're intruding on someone's shooting. But anyway, because of who she was, she took us on and they were making a film called Hell Below Zero. And it was pitch black. And right at the end, I could see this light and we got closer and closer and closer. And then I could see these people sitting round watching this ship's cabin, great big ship's cabin, and standing rehearsing his lines was our hero, Alan Ladd.
Wouldn't
mean much to me, you, Alan Ladd, but to us, he was a big, big star, big Western.
Yeah.
And he was rehearsing his lines, and I kept thinking to myself, A, I can't believe I'm seeing Alan Ladd, and B, how did they get this massive cabin into this building? But when there was a break, I just wandered around the back, and of course, it was all scaffold poles and bits of wood, and I thought, the whole thing is fantasy. This is a wonderful industry, you know, it's make-believe and
movie magic.
And I was totally hooked. And cut a long story short, when my national service was over, I hadn't decided. It was 5 years since I saw that set. I thought there was no harm done. I could just ring and send her a letter, which I did. How do people enter the film industry? And to my amazement, after all those years, she wrote back and said, Norman, come and meet me. And we had a chat and she said, we are short of someone in the editing department. I didn't know what that meant. And she took me into this tiny room with a bloke in the corner running film through a machine. And I thought, this isn't quite what I had in mind, actually. I imagined cameras and sound crews and stuff. But anyway, she said, you know, have a try, see what you think. And slowly but surely, every time they gave me the film to take up to the projection box, because they were having a running, I could see the film was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I realized that this is where they were actually assembling the picture. This was the, and I became quite hooked on the whole idea of somebody cutting all those shots together. Because when you see rushes, and every scene is taken from so many different angles, and somebody has to decide when and where you will be on which shot. And I became intrigued on the whole skill of doing that.
So whose decision are those things where...
That's the editor's shot.
The picture's coming, like, we'll choose this shot. Do they, how much influence on what sound effects is used? Do they sort of say, can you use this one, or... I'd like you to produce this sound for this.
Oh, but at that stage, all you're concentrating on is cutting the film together.
Right. Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with sound.
Right.
The sound people don't come on until the film's completed. Otherwise, they keep saying, well, you didn't tell me you were going to do that.
Right, okay.
But once they can see an assembled film, it's nothing like the final film. But usually about a week after the end of shooting, you have got an assembled production, and the director, the editor, and various other people sit back and think, well, what have we got? And then from then on, you start to whittle it down. Oh. And that's when the sound editors come on, because they can now, that's the whole film, and they can work their way through reel by reel, deciding what's good enough for the final film and what isn't.
Yeah.
And what isn't, they know they've got to start replacing.
It's absolutely fascinating.
So it's like you're sprinkling the final bit of magic on it. It's almost like the icing on the cake kind of thing in some ways, would you say?
Ah, but don't forget, we're talking about Bond films here. So many films, you're just replacing sound that everybody knows will be on there, you know?
Yeah.
But with Bonds, there are sounds which normally you wouldn't ever heard before. And this was why Dr. No was quite tough, because all the films starting to move slightly into the futuristic idea with gadgets and flying hats and things and wheels turning that you've never normally would see.
Yeah.
But the sound industry was still lagging behind.
Mm.
But you could go to sound effects libraries, and have a list. Most of the things you would find there, but once it became electronic, well, no, we haven't got anything quite like that. And purely by chance, I heard that somebody said, have you heard about the BBC Radiophonic Workshop? And I hadn't. And they said, no. Well, what it is, they've set them up to try and develop music that would suit space-type films, you know, so that it's not the usual sort of violins and things, but more war-type things. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting.
That does, yeah.
And on Goldfinger, when he's strapped out onto this platform and they're going to bring the beam down.
Oh, yeah.
I do have a new toy, but considerably more practical. You are looking at an industrial laser, which emits an extraordinary light not to be found in nature. It can project a spot on the moon, or at closer range, cut through solid metal. I will show you.
I started the beam with a shot, you know, firework going off, and then I wanted a sound for that beam, and I could hear it in my mind, but libraries said, no, I've got nothing like that. So anyway, I called these people. The guy came down, he looked at it, and he went away, and a week later, exactly the right sound came back. Peter was a bit nervous about it. He thought it was probably a little bit strong on the ears. But everybody else said, Norm, that's a fantastic sound.
Oh, wow.
Whether it's still in the film, I'm not sure. But I think the last time I saw, I wasn't too sure. It was a whip crack. A whip crack set it off, and then you had this steely sound. So I thought, well, these people are wonderful, you know, at least you know that there's always an outlet if you're really stuck. And you only live twice.
Oh.
They had this rocket descending into the volcano and also taking off.
Yeah.
And I knew that would take, so much work. Where would I start with a thing like that, you know? So I called them in and I said, I'll tell you what, look, you just make one basic sound that covers it. and then I'll add and subtract. And they said, OK, fair enough. And when it came back, it was the complete sound.
Oh, lovely.
I just sat back and said, fine, wound it in. And I always remember Peter Hunt said, I'm crazy about the rocket sound.
Yeah.
And I thought, I wish I could say, well, you know, I did it. But I didn't. But that's how valuable it was.
Yeah.
Whereas in Dr. No, without doubt, I have never known tension like I had on Dr. No. Because the most difficult sound of all, I've managed to, with the mixer, build all the difficult sounds first. This is what I learned from Winston Ryder. Look at the film, pick out all the challenges, get them done early so that when you're dubbing, you don't have to stop them and say, I've got to make this sound. It's already there. So I did it on Dr. No. I did the electronic doors in Dr. No's apartment.
Here we are. This will be your room, Mr. Bond. Don't hesitate to ring if there's anything else you want. Anything at all.
Such as two air tickets to London.
I'll leave you two dear people in peace.
I did the sound of the lift when they go in there. I didn't want it to sound like Marks and Spencer's. I did when he was in the tunnel. I did the water crashing.
Amazing
that
noises.
Is the most iconic sound. When I think of Dr. No, that's the sound I think of that film.
Yeah.
Water crashing and that electronic kind of sound while he's in the tunnel.
How amazing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it which is unscored in that scene. It is all sound design, sound effects.
Yes.
And it really sells the scene.
Oh, not covered with music, was it?
No.
The other thing I made was the crushing of the... When Dr. No crushes that. That's my favourite sound of all time. Oh. Yeah.
You persist in trying to provoke me, Mr. Bond. I could have had you killed in the swamp.
And why didn't you?
I thought you less stupid. Usually when a man gets in my way...
But no, I was in the sound effects library and I was just going through my list and suddenly I heard this sound that you heard.
Yeah.
I said, what's that over there? They said, oh, don't worry, Norm, it's just they're going through some electronics. I said, yeah, I know, but that is an amazing sound. I said, immediately I thought of him in that tunnel.
Yeah.
And
it
had that twang when he drops and I thought, fantastic that is. So I said, well, I'll have a copy of that. And I took it back and I knew they had music. So I thought, well, I can't lay it up and say, this is what I'm doing. I just said, this is a possibility. And unbeknown to me, when they were mixing it, they didn't like the music. And they said, has Norman got anything? And they looked at the chart and they said, oh, well, to my joy, they played it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
That really made my day. But anyway, back to my attention.
Yes, yeah.
I went through and got all the sound, but the one thing I could not do was find a machine for when Bond goes onto the gantry and turns that wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
Such a vital sound because it was the nuclear reactor and so it affected the whole of the end of the film.
Yeah.
And I kept looking for a machine that not only if I switched it on, it would go 1-1-1-1-1, but also perhaps a control that would raise the pitch.
Yes.
And they were going through the dubbing. They'd gone through, I think there were 12 reels. They'd reached reel 11 and I still hadn't got sound. And I was absolutely petrified. Mm. Because not only was my reputation, but the film was at stake. Anyway, in desperation, I went to the guy who was responsible for maintaining all the sound equipment, all the electronic sound equipment and everything. And I said, I told him the problem. I said, is there any chance you could come up with anything? He said, well, not really, but I'll give it some thought. And about two or three days later, he called me to the recording theatre, and I looked, and I could not believe this bit of gadgetry was so ridiculous. You know, bits of this, bits of that. I said, oh. He said, no, Norm, hold on. He said, switch it on. I switched it on. And it was going, wah, 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 wah. I said, oh, but. He said, no. And he gave me another one. He said, turn that. And I turned it, and it went, wah, 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 wah,
wah. Oh.
I'm getting hot thinking about it.
Oh.
And everyone in the theatre said, that is unbelievable. You have invented a machine.
Yes. Yeah.
To this day, I don't know how he did it.
That's incredible.
Saved my life and my reputation.
Yeah. So the sound designer, they create and suggest, and then do you suggest, I want this sound? To create
the sound is up to me,
right?
And I just have to hope that whatever I create, they approve of.
Right. Okay. Right.
Yes, and it was interesting that sounds are so important on Bond because at Pima Studios, the head mixer there, the one that mixed everything together, his name was McCullum. Gordon McCullum, and he had a temper like nothing. I mean, if things weren't going right, he would storm out and everyone kept quiet. And I was more nervous about working with Gordon than I was any other aspect of it. But anyway, unbeknown to me, when the first cut was finished, they showed it to the sound department. And I was in my room and I heard a tap on my door. And when I opened it, Gordon McCullum was standing there like a little boy. He said, when are we going to start? And he knew that I would be having to create all those different sounds. He knew that, you know, and he couldn't wait to get his hands on my ingredients, because when you go in there with about six different tracks to create one sound, it's fascinating. You try three with two, four with one, six with this, and eventually you say, that's the best, we've got it, we've made it, and then he makes it. And he knew he was looking forward to that, and we had those lovely sessions, and we worked as a team from then on. It was great.
You mentioned Dr. No crushing. Can you tell us how that was done with his glove?
Well, obviously, I can't remember all the different tracks. But obviously, the first one would have been a beer can. And
oh, right, okay.
Make a start with that. And there were two or three sounds. But what I love about it is when he drops it and it hits the table, it goes bang.
Yes.
And then when it hits the floor, it goes bang. And I think, Norm, how did you do that? What did you use for that? Because it showed how threatening it was and how amazing that he could crush it. It was that
heavy.
Yeah,
yeah.
But as Gordon said, on these films, we can contribute sound-wise rather than just compliment.
Yes, yeah. Mm.
Most pictures you just compliment, you know. If there's a door closed, you put a door closed. But in the Bonds, there were times when I was on a TV program once. I've forgotten the lady's name now, but she had a series. And on this particular one, it was about awards. And I went on it, and she said, introduce Norman. So I said, when you throw a hat in the air, this is the sound it makes. This is what it makes when Norman does it. And she showed this shot. And do you know, the whole place applauded.
Oh, it's amazing.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And that's the odd job. The odd job's odd amazing job. Bowler hat.
Yeah. Then she rang the... ran the one with the turning of the thing.
Okay,
turning of the wheel, and no one made a sound. Yeah. To them, that's what you do. I mean, that's what it did. When you turn that wheel, it makes that noise. End of story.
But you do, as viewers, you just accept that that is the correct noise.
Yes, definitely.
If you don't notice it almost, that's good. If you thought, this doesn't sound like the right sound for whatever's happening on screen, then that's a problem, isn't it?
Yes, you're right.
It needs to sound what you imagine that thing to be like.
You couldn't have said it more accurately, because my pride in Goldfinger is the crushing
oh, yeah.
of the car.
The car, yes, yeah.
because the sound came back up in sort of bits and pieces, I started right from scratch. I thought, yeah, I think I could do this very well. But what I was missing was the most important sound of all, which was these jaws coming up during the crushing and going back. And I thought, come on, Norman, you've got a problem here. Where are you going to get a machine that will make that sort of sound? Anyway, I was working one day and I said to my assistant, what's going on outside? She said, oh, don't worry, they're doing some maintenance on the car park. I said, yeah, but listen. And I could hear this. I rushed out. I said, what's this machine? They said, oh, it's... They told me what it was. But I said, don't go anywhere. Stay where you are. Oh. I rushed back to find my sound mixer. He said, Norman, I'm sorry, mate, I can't come. I said, we're going to be shooting up for the rest of the day. I said, well, give me a machine and I'll record it. He said, I haven't got any. I said, well, what's that? He said, oh, you can't have that. That's the toy recorder I bought for my son. I said, well, does it record? He said, well, it records, but it's a toy. I said, well, give it to me. I rushed back and the mic was about that size and I tried to look very professional and I recorded it. And laid it all up, you know, and I put it on the chart. I didn't say anything. And I waited for them to say Norman. But they didn't.
Oh, gosh.
And I just didn't say a word. And that was my secret for years, that was.
So that remained in the final film?
Oh, though? Definitely, because it was so powerful. And I love
fantastic.
It.
Fantastic.
And the whole, with the breaking glass and everything, I'm very proud of that. But nobody take, like one of you said, it's just... what people expect.
That's what
a crusher does.
But as I think of Goldfinger, I think there's a real complementary nature of some of the big sounds to deliberately take the music score out of. So the crusher's in, there's no music score. So you're focusing on that sound.
That's right. You're right there.
The same is with the Odd Job fight at the end. Because they take out the score. All you've got is that buzzing noise of like the...
machine.
The machine.
Yes. Boom, 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 boom.
Absolutely. Throughout
that. That makes the tension.
It's like, it's basically the soundtrack. That's the score for that scene. It's
brilliant. You're so right. I wasn't sure about that sound, whether everyone would approve of that, because that was the bomb. But I thought it had that bit of tension. And people often say that was a success.
Brilliant.
Because you've got that noise, then you've got the clicking of
the clicking,
And then, so were you involved in when it electrocutes himself, those noises as well?
Yes.
That's a fantastic, it's a brilliant scene, isn't it? I
mean, yes.
It's just very memorable.
Yeah.
My word. So the throwing of the hat, how on earth did you get that noise? Because obviously most people don't have one of those types of hats on them, do they, to check whether it works?
My metal rimmed hat.
I know, I've been asked that countless times. I can't remember all, but what I can remember is, because of my age, I remembered a couple of toys that we had when we were little kids, you know, wartime. And I said to my assistant, I said, go round all the toy shops. I think it's very, very unlikely. But I gave him two toys. And to my amazement, he came back with them. I said, I don't know how you did that, because these were way, way back. But very, very simply, one of them was a disc. Sometimes they were cardboard, sometimes they were metal. And the strange way string was put through the middle was we used to hold it in our hands like this and then pull it out. And that, by pulling out the strings, the disc spun. And it used to go... Oh, we loved it. We could do all that all day. You know? And sometimes if it was metal, we'd try and cut something on the disc. Anyway, we took that into recording theatre and we recorded it. And the other one was a piece of metal about this long that was twisted all the way down. And we had a little propeller that we put on the top and it spun its way to the bottom. And then we used to love this. We used to push it up to the top and it flew off and it would flow all around the room, you know. So we took that into the recording room and they followed it with the mic. They're the only two I can remember, but there were more. And then I said, we must have something when it leaves the hand because you need the threat of this thing. This isn't cardboard. This is a metal hat, you know. And we tried lots and lots of things. And in the end, I said, I'll tell you what, let's get a carpenter's saw. And we got this carpenter's saw and we put it like that and we just twang the end of it. And we said, yes, we got it. This doom as it left. Most people would say, well, I didn't hear anything, but I know it's there.
Many people have tried to involve themselves in my affairs, unsuccessfully.
Remarkable. But what does a club secretary have to say?
Oh, nothing, Mr. Bond.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I own the club.
I love that you're telling us that these noises are made by toys, or that you recorded something on a toy recorder, because it's the imagination of that. And when we were kids and we grew up, it was that imagination that we see on the screen and we hear that made us have this imagination for Bond. It's just so heartening to hear.
Yes, okay.
I'm brilliant.
Pleased.
Yeah.
But you must have such a good ear. You must have such a good ear for what I think that could sound like.
Instinctively, you feel how that sound should be.
Yeah.
And so that's why when these people came from the BBC workshop, I could tell them exactly. I could say, right, I wanted to have this, that, and the other. And they'd say, fine, okay. And they would copy that. But if I hadn't said that, they'd say, well, what do you want?
Yeah. It's difficult, isn't it?
And that's why with the beam on Bond, they made it exactly as I described it.
Yeah.
Thin, steely sound.
Yeah.
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
That's a perfect mix of music and sound effect.
Two words you may have overheard, which cannot possibly have any significance to you or anyone in your organization. Can you afford to take that chance?
I mean, you're working with John Barry, aren't you? At what stage does his music come in to all this? Is that after you've put the sounds on?
It's interesting. One of the biggest problems with films is because of the time factor, everything is done to time.
Yeah.
And by the time a composer really can't really start showing an interest until the film is virtually fine cut.
Yeah.
Because he can't start writing music and then you say, oh, I'm sorry, we've altered that scene a bit.
Yeah.
So the problem is that the composer and the sound effects people can't come together, look at the screen and say, right, they want music on here. So how are we going to do it so that mine's heard and yours is heard? Because so often the sound effects person would spend ages creating something, and then the music doesn't go with it. So you have to decide whether you're going to have the sound effects or the music. Yeah. Usually the music won.
Yes, of course.
And that was could be very, very disappointing. And so one day, it was on Thunderball, and he came to view the cut.
Who did? John Barrett?
John Barrett.
Yeah, okay.
And I didn't really think much about it. But when we finished, he came over. He said, "Norman, I'm so glad I came today." And I know what it was, because when we were viewing the film, there was so much underwater that was just silence.
Yes.
It was just spacing, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, this isn't fair on people when they watch the film. And I'd already started to experiment with underwater sounds. Oh. I was slowing sounds up to get the bass and that. So I found one. I thought, that's it. That's the one for me. So I wound it into all the cutting copy. So now at least you could hear something when you saw the stuff. John Barry came over. He said, "Norman, I'm so glad. Now I know what you're doing. That's changed my mind." He said, "I was going to put 6 trombones over that."
Whoa.
And I said, "John, isn't it a shame that we can't always work like this? Because it would be so much more professional for you to know what I'm doing and I know what you're doing, or we could discuss who's going to take over which bit, but we can't, there's no time." So that was one occasion when we really gained from him hearing something I was doing.
Mm. Those underwater scenes are so well, the sound on those are amazing, because, again, it hasn't been done before, anything like that, has
Not
it?
To that extent, no. That's the only film that I feel that could have been sort of thought out a bit differently, really. To have so much underwater with all those bubbles and all those... No, you didn't know where to stop and start. So, you know, in fact, I had one guy I brought on whose job was bubbles.
Right, right.
But where do you stop and start, you know, when you've got about 8 guys all going under, there's bubbles there.
True.
Oh, no. I thought it was a bit OTT myself.
Yeah. That's what a lot of people say. It was pioneering, though, and John's music is, we say it's the sound of underwater. It's just... It does really help, doesn't it? I think.
Yeah, I guess so, yes. It was just the bubbles.
The bubbles, yeah.
How many to have and when not to have them.
Must have been lots of underwater footage that had to be cut down.
Oh, yeah.
Because the editing in that is very difficult.
Yes,
I imagine.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It worked, you know.
Oh, it did. From Rush With Love, I hope you're involved in this sound, but in the pre-title sequence, there's an agent you think is Bond, but it's actually the Spectre camp, where there's a training camp, and they kill Bond, but it isn't him, and they take off his rubber mask to reveal that it is another agent. Now, that noise of the rubber mask coming off is I love it. I think it's brilliant.
Well, I'm going to be really, really honest with you.
Please, honest.
That was the only time in all those films they said, "Norm, that's not quite up to it."
They didn't want it?
No, and they were dubbing. And I'd done in record, because, you know, a lot of my stuff was done in a recording theatre, all the footsteps and movement and clonks and bocks and machines and that, all done in the recording theatre. And I thought I'd got it right. But Peter didn't think it was right.
Right.
And so apparently they stopped dubbing, because I was still working in my cutting room. They stopped dubbing, brought something in, got and recorded it.
Oh, right.
So, you know,
Sorry.
No. I think that's great, because it proves that it needed to be something that people... I agree with you, it's perfect.
It's lovely, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it's almost like two movements, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the only time, though, they ever criticised one of my sounds.
Well, that's not bad, is it, if it's the only time? Yeah.
It's a good, good ratio, that, isn't it? Yeah.
In From Rush With Love, there's the famous fight scene on the train.
Oof.
Now, how was that to do the sound for that?
Yes, that to me is probably one of, apart from the crushing, yes, as a scene, that's my favourite scene.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Yes,
isn't it?
That was all recorded in a recording theatre.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Because there are, you probably know this, but there are people called footsteps and effects artists.
Yeah.
And they're paid. We got to know them, you know, they were so regular. And they would come in and they would look at the screen and they could synchronise footsteps perfectly. They always knew what to put on their feet to get that sound. Of course, those theatres always had loads and loads of props, and they'd say, well, let's have one of those and one of those. They looked at the screen. I was in the recorder with the mixer, and it was like a team thing. And every time I saw the recording of what they'd just done, I said, wow, that's absolutely fantastic. Because we had all the right surfaces, we had the right doors and the right, you know, they're banging this and banging that, aren't they? But I love that scene. And what was so nice for me was that there was no music.
Mm. Oh, yes, much better definitely. Without it.
And because the bullet went through the glass, I was able to have my whistle of the train and the.
It does work much better. I think fights, particularly unscored, you're really in. You feel the constraints of that small cabin, don't you, on the train?
Yes.
It just makes it so much more realistic.
It is a fantastic scene, isn't it?
It's such a contrast to the Goldfinger one. Both equally brilliant.
Yeah.
But you, in From Russia with Love, you've got a very claustrophobic, frenetic fight, which is all sounds of that, you know, rushing winds and of the train and stuff. And then you've got an odd job, very slow, tense fight.
Yeah.
Two completely contrasting styles contrasting sounds, but both have that incredible tension in them. It's just brilliant. Oh. So diverse.
Yes, and you don't very often see two men in suits fighting each other.
No. Not at all.
It's quite a scene, that. Definitely quite a scene.
You won't be needing this, old man.
If you're enjoying Really 007, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram? Look us up at Really 007 Pod. If you do not, you will be shot!
When you were first sort of working on all, particularly Dr. No, did you know Sean Connery? Were you thinking, looking at this footage of him, this guy is going to be a star? Could you tell that this guy was Bond?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because people have asked, the question I'm always asked is, you worked on Dr. No, did you all realise that it was going to be such a success?
Yeah, and
the answer is, no, they did not.
No.
Nobody had any idea. We, as far as we were concerned, it had two choices. It was either going to be a huge success or a complete flop.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think what it was is because the film was split into two halves. We knew we had a fantastic Bond. We knew we had Ursula, which was just stunning.
Yeah.
We knew we had scenes like the tarantula, which people used to, I could tell people used to go, whew.
Yeah. Yeah.
But how are people going to react to Dr. No?
Right,
this character, you know.
fantasy
character. Yeah. So we just didn't know how the two were going to work. And also Bond was a slightly light, not lightweight spy, but, you know, he had his jovial moments. You know, he wasn't your usual spy, was he? No. He didn't go around. He was just a very handsome man.
You know?
I did go to a, I don't know how I ended up at a sneak preview once. And we were in a cinema there. We were in the forecourt and Harry was there. And it was a sneak preview. And do you know the terror on that man's face? I'd never seen him look like that. Normally he was just Harry. But he was standing there looking like this, and I thought, Harry, you're really scared. And when they all filed out with a big smile on their face, I could tell the relief.
You knew it then, yeah.
Yeah, but it proves just how unknown the future was of that film.
Mm.
And it, because it was different, wasn't it? When have you ever seen a film like Dr. No?
No. No, it's true.
It is, because if that went wrong, we wouldn't be here today, would we?
No,
it's true. There wouldn't have been From Rush With Love. No. No Goldfinger, no other Bonds. It's just, and here we are 60 plus years on. It must fill you with pride that you're a part of that original, very first, and it was all created.
Very, very lucky to have met Peter at the time, and he was lucky to get the film.
Yeah.
But the biggest problem on Dr. No, not only was I given my very first chance, no one had ever been promoted to that job from assistant to a sound effects editor. I mean, it's unheard of.
Yeah.
But the unfairness of it all was that because of the budget, when I did those recordings of all those sounds, I got this phone call saying, Norman, you are costing us a fortune. This has got to stop. We can't afford it. The budget's too tight. I thought, wait a minute, it's my first time, I'm trying to be professional, and you're telling me I've got to stop doing what I'm doing. It was very, very unfortunate. And it made life rather intolerant for me. And it was just fortunate that I'd made all those sounds before they came to me.
Right.
Otherwise, I would never have done them. So when we came on to Rush With Love, I thought, are we going to go through this again or what? Yeah. And there was a scene in the gypsy camp in Turkey. All shot on the back lot at Pinewood.
Yeah.
I learned from Wind Rider, the way to bring a scene to life is voices. He was crazy about voices, always having voices, all distant voices. Oh. I went into the production office, tongue in cheek. He said, what do you want, Norm? I said, right, what I'm going to need, I want 10 Turkish women, 10 Turkish men, and as many Russians as you can get. And he looked at the calendar. He said, Thursday be all right?
Gosh, I didn't realise.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I thought, now we're making movies, you know. And I was so grateful. I was so grateful. They all turned up and I loved that sound, that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And when we were dubbing, Terence stood there and up it came. He said, where are all these voices from? Peter said, Norman recorded them. Why? He just couldn't believe it.
Because the extras, obviously, they don't speak, do you, when you're recording a scene? All that sound has to be added on afterwards. Because you just need the people, the main characters speaking to collect the sound, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Because they don't want to pick up the outside, any background noise, do they, really?
And not when you're shooting.
No, that's to be added later.
No. There might have been the odd, you know, bit of chatter going on, but no, basically, that was it.
Were you involved in the attaché case, the noises of the briefcase?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, these are
the
so...
When it blew up, you mean? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, talcum powder, yeah.
Yeah.
Weather mixer was very helpful. When you're on the outside of the train and then when you're in the corridor of the train, you've got that loud rattle, rattle, rattle.
Yeah.
When you come into the carriage, it's much more subdued.
Yeah.
So I thought, God, have I got to keep laying that one and then cut to another sound? But he said, no, Norman, I think I've cracked this for you. So all he did, at the moment I put a cue when we were going into the thing, and he just switched the tone of took the bass out or took whatever, you know, I don't know enough about the technology of sound, but he just altered the sound to fit the interior. So it took all that work off my back.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So on to Goldfinger, we've mentioned, you know, the amazing work you've done on that. Mm. Could you tell us a bit about how you found out you'd been, well, first nominated for an Academy Award? How did that come about?
Peter and I was still his assistant, and we worked on Ipcress File.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is one film I knew was going to be a success.
Yes, yeah.
And I was just in a recording theatre with all the guys and things, and Peter came in and said, can I just stop you a second? He said, I've received a telegram here, he said, from the Academy, and they want to know who was responsible for the sound effects on Goldfinger. So we all looked at him in surprise, and we said, well, Pete, you know that better than anybody. and he sort of didn't know what to say and walked out, and we just carried on working because we naturally thought, oh, well, they're obviously just getting some kind of a database about who worked on what and who did what on what. And it was only about a couple of weeks later when I was officially told that I had been nominated for an Oscar. And the biggest shock of all was that we had never heard of a sound effects award.
Didn't,
as far as we were concerned, it didn't exist. They'd only ever had a sound award, and that's always confusing because how do you judge who was responsible for the sound of a picture when there's so many different people have worked on it?
It's a massive department,
And I think what must have happened is the American Guild of Editors must have said to the Academy, look, you really ought to introduce a sound effects award because of the amount of work that's involved in some of these films is colossal, you know? So they obviously did. And in 1964, they introduced it, and it was won by a film called It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which I've never seen, so I don't know what was in it. And so my wife and I said, well, obviously, we're not going to win anything, are we? So let's go to the and have a really good experience of America and so on, and the awards ceremony. But then when I arrived at my hotel, they gave me a program of the event, and to my amazement, there were only two nominated. In some ways, I was rather disappointed in a way. I thought, this means only two of us have got the chance.
Yes, I
thought it would have been nicer if there had been four or five. But anyway, I knew then that the chances were very, very high. Mm. I had to take it seriously.
Yeah. That was the first Oscar nomination that a Bond film had.
Yes, it was, yeah.
So I presume the producers and everybody were delighted
big,
with
big
this.
Big celebration, surely.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't remember them coming over to me or doing anything. It's sort of somebody in the production office asked me to come in, and he was ringing various people and saying, we've got an Oscar here, hoping that they might get a bit of publicity.
Yeah.
That was pretty well it, but it was an incredible experience, and I really, really enjoyed it. We were able to see some more of America while we were there.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Because, I mean, everything was done so quickly.
Yeah.
Because I presume you had to work on Thunderball not long after. So you had some spare time to sort of go there and enjoy
it.
That's great, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes.
When it was the ceremony, who did you meet, and what other sort of films were in nomination? Can you remember any of that?
No, I can't. People say, was it nerve-wracking going up on that stage?
Yeah.
But the thing was that immediately the orchestra struck up with Goldfinger.
Oh, did they?
Oh, wow.
And all the applause. And I was drowned by sound. So I just thought, well, I'm part of this. And any tension vanished.
It's unbelievable.
And then when I got on the stage and looked out, it was something to do with the lighting, but instead of staring at individual faces looking at me, it was more like a blur. And so I was just talking to this blur, so I didn't have any nerves or anything.
Achievement in sound effects are Norman Wanstall for Goldfinger, Robert L. Bratton for The Lively Set, and the winner... The winner is Norman Wanstall for Goldfinger.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's very difficult to say thank you as sincerely as I'd like to now. But I'm a technician, so maybe I can leave the eloquence to the artists that follow. But on behalf of the sound departments that I've worked with and my production company and myself, may I thank you all very sincerely for this tremendous honour And what's more, may I thank you for the opportunity of coming to your wonderful country. I think for my wife and I, this trip is going to be the greatest experience of our lives. Thank you very much indeed.
John, can you get, here it is with, obviously, Norman's... This is incredible.
Second, giving it to you again. Well done, Norman.
We'll put the Goldfinger tune on.
Go on, I'll let you hold it if that's all right.
Okay.
Yeah. And it is heavy, isn't it?
It is very, very heavy.
Yeah. Goodness me.
And what's remarkable is when you think how old that is and it's still immaculate.
It is, isn't it?
It really is.
And the irony, it's made of gold, isn't it?
The
Goldfinger.
The final coating is gold.
Well, no wonder it's last like that.
Yeah.
Goodness.
It's quite interesting because when I first went on my apprenticeship at Pinewood, in the main building there, they had a glass case and they had two or three Oscars, but they had worn over time. And it was so sad to see the surface was wearing off. And whereas this, look, nothing's happened to it.
So have you not had to do anything to it?
Nothing at all. Oh, only the bottom part there.
Right.
Where it actually says who is what.
Look at that. And it's just you, isn't it? You know, a lot of the Oscars for sound now, there's about four or five people who win it. But it's just Norman Wanstall there. It's amazing.
I suppose because that's my credit.
Yeah.
I don't know whether all those people you're talking about had a credit.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's two or three awards now. It's expanded for sound. There's sound mixing, isn't there?
But it keeps changing. They had this for about two or three years. Then they cut it out. Then they brought it back.
Right.
And then they introduced one for sound editing. And I thought, I feel sorry for the people that have got to nominate because they wouldn't know what sound editing means.
No.
Can I ask, when you went back into the sound department after the Oscar, was like, the team must have been so thrilled for you. Like, big clap or a real team effort or...
I do have a photo. I mean, I've got lots of photographs, maybe afterwards. But I do have one with the whole Pinewood sound. When I say the whole, there was the head of sound, there was Gordon McCullum, of course.
Yeah.
Myself and the man that used to do the recording in the theatre. He was the one that did the recorded that fight in the train, So we were all involved in sound and so they brought us all together and me holding that.
Oh.
Probably show it to you later if you wanted to.
Yeah, yeah. It is incredible. That's nearly 60 years old as well, isn't it?
Yes.
And you've got, lovely photographs of it. Have you managed to see the ceremony again? Was it... Because they didn't used to show it, did they, in England then?
No. And I think at one time it was you could never ever see anything from the past. It was like it all went into a vault.
Yeah.
And so when it was amazing really that my son was talking to someone at work and he mentioned the Bonds and everything. And the chap said, "Oh," he said, "my son's crazy about the Bonds. I can't wait to tell him." And when he told him his son about the Oscar, this 7-year-old boy went straight onto YouTube.
Right.
Seven years old. And that's how it was exposed. No one knew it was on.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it's been it's re-emerged, hasn't it? All this footage and. You said, just tell us a story about this now. There's a picture above you, a lovely picture of you and your wife with the award.
Oh, yeah. Yes, this is not the picture that I have upstairs, which is was taken at the time. And nobody knew that this picture existed. I certainly didn't. Nobody else ever mentioned it. But they suddenly, in America, put it on the market for sale. And this chap, what was his name now? Yeah, Steve Oxenrider, he said, "No, I don't want someone else to have that. I think Norman should have that." He bought it and then sent it to me.
Yeah,
and
that's
that is an incredible gesture.
It is, yeah.
Absolutely incredible. Is.
And how long ago was this that you were given this photograph?
Oh, it's probably about 4 or 5 years.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh. So after all that time.
After all that time.
Yeah. So that was there like a, did you go to any after parties?
Yes.
I mean? Oh, did you? Oh, wonderful.
Yes, we, after the ceremony, we all got into limousines and drove off to this hotel where they had, you had, we were all in our, you know, separate parties, tables, and we had this very nice meal and the music was up and everyone was dancing.
Oh.
And I always said to people, where my wife and I laughed, was if you bumped into someone on the dance floor, it was probably Gregory Peck. Or
oh, right. Yeah. Oh, dear.
You sort of think, oh, I'm sorry.
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
did it feel like that sort of still the golden age of Hollywood when you
very,
were there?
Very, very much so. Yeah. Because we were so close to the front, because all nominees obviously have less time to go up onto the stage. Yeah. And while we were all waiting, you sort of looked round and virtually every face behind you was famous.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely amazing.
Wow.
Quite an event.
Yeah.
Were any of the other Bond representatives there, even though they weren't necessarily nominated, or were you the exclusive like Bond representative at the Oscars?
20th Century Fox. They looked after me.
Right.
And
right.
And it was their table. And,
ah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing.
They were proud to have it on the...
Everywhere,
all the Oscars were obviously on the... with the people that had won them. I could tell they were pleased to have at least one on on the table.
Yeah.
But then you had to give it back because they had to be marked.
Yeah.
You
know. It's the film Goldfinger where the gadgets really come in. So the thing he puts the tracker on his car, the thing that he puts in his heel. I don't... Can you remember all this?
Oh, the homing device.
Yeah, the homing device, yeah. Takes his shoe, doesn't he, and puts it in there. And there's loads of noises like that. It's just amazing.
Here's a nice little transmitting device called a Homer. You prime it by pressing that back like this. You see? The smaller model is now standard field issue, to be fitted into the heel of your shoe. Its larger brother is magnetic.
Is there a peep in the car?
Yeah.
Auto visual, range 150 miles.
Ingenious and useful too. Allow a man to stop off for a quick one en route.
It has not been perfected out of years of patient research entirely for that purpose, 007.
You can remember all this now.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I knew I wouldn't be able to find that peep. So what I did, I found a pee, you know, a long sound, and then just cut a piece in each time.
Yeah. Just, oh, is that
genius?
How it's done?
Genius.
We've noticed, I think maybe more on the later ones, a lot of these sound effects have been repeated in more Bond films.
Ah,
so I know, like, John
the
Glenn.
The jaw sock.
They love the certain sounds that... There's particular screams and things like that they... Like the Wilhelm scream has been used, hasn't
pigeons
it?
Pigeons flapping.
Yeah,
those kind of things, yeah.
And did you use any of your sound effects again in other films?
I don't think so.
No.
No. The one that became overused was the jaw sock, because... Sound editors tried for years to, you know, to get a jaw sock that sounded right. But there was one in the library that did the job. One session somewhere in history, they did it and they said, yes, great.
Yeah.
And it went into the library and we've used everyone. But you can hear it. It's the same sound. And a lot of people have said to me, Norm, we've heard the same jaw sock in so many films. So obviously you try according to what the sock is. You know, it might be on the body. It might be, you know, on the neck. But anything to do with the face always had that one from the library.
You can hear it in your head now, can't you? The same, yeah, it is.
It just works. So I don't know how they did it.
That's fantastic, yeah. In Doctor No as well, you've got the silencer in the famous scene with Professor Dent.
Oh.
So there's guns and things like that.
Oh, by the way, that was the one I forgot to say.
Yeah.
That was the first sound I made with Gordon was the silence pistol.
One of the greatest scenes in all of the James Bond films.
I mean, if that's the place you started, that is something else.
Mr. Smith and Wesson, and you've had your six.
It's very Ian Fleming. It's Sean. He's absolute best there, isn't he?
Yeah, really.
In fact, I've always been amazed that we got away with it because a hero never kills anyone in cold blood.
It's cold
like
blood
that.
Is, yeah, yeah,
true.
And was it a PG at the time?
Yeah.
Like, children could see that film, couldn't they, I think?
I think it was put under question by the censors.
Yeah, yeah.
The only regret I have, and it's funny, actually, I've carried this with me for a long time, is that I should have made another silenced pistol that was just slightly different. One that had a bit of a pew in it rather than just a doo, you know.
Yeah.
And so that they didn't always sound exactly the same. And if in that particular scene, because he comes in and bangs, bang, 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 bang on the bed, it would have been nice if Sean's had been very slightly different.
Oh, well, no, I don't. Yeah, I don't have any regrets.
I wouldn't regret about that, Norman. I mean, wow. Yeah.
There's explosions as well in a lot of these films, aren't there?
Yes, that's all library.
Goodness me, yeah.
The libraries are very, very good. You know, there's so much in the libraries that you could get.
What are these you have here, Norman?
So, look, basically every day, I mean, they're the wrong size, aren't they? But usually every day would come in about 3,000 feet of this film. Just that would that come in.
Clockwork Orange.
I know, I've just seen that.
And then 3,000 feet of sound, it would come in.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right, now the assistant now has got to try and synchronise.
Oh, my word.
Gosh. So the reason, all he does is he starts from the front and he looks and he runs it on the machine and he can see the clapper boy there going, whoa, yeah, whoa, 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 whoa. And where it touches, he marks it and writes on it, 28, take 3.
Right.
Bang. And then he runs this and he hears him say, 28, take 3, bang. And he marks it. So now you're in sync.
That's perfect, isn't it? Yeah.
So then he would run it through one of these.
Right.
Right the way through until he got to the end of it, cut it off, and then he would do the next shot. Hear the clapper, time it up. So by the time he'd reached the end, he'd have two rolls all in sync.
Gosh, wow. That's amazing, isn't it?
All ready to take into the viewing theatre at lunchtime when you show the rushes to the rest of the crew.
Wow.
But without those clapper boards, you wouldn't know where to start.
Right. So there is an origin to everything, all these customs. And
But I would think that would be a quiz question.
Definitely.
Only one in thousands could answer.
That's amazing. So do you have any of the original reels or anything? Are they at Pinewood?
Well, what I have got... And as you're very special people, this is actually a married print. But when the film is completely finished, the sound and picture are put on. Can you see the sound at the top there?
Yeah.
It's optical.
Oh, my word. That is Goldfinger.
Is it really?
Yes.
Oh, my word. Which scene's this?
So as you three are rather special, I'll give you 3-4 frames each.
Oh, no. You don't have to. That's very kind of you, Norman.
It's Goldfinger going up.
He's got the coat on, is he?
Yeah,
near the end in Fort Knox. Is it that bit?
I'll cut a bit off.
Oh my word!
Incredibly kind.
So what I've got is a roll of film as it comes in each day.
Yeah, yeah.
And those two now can run through that machine. That's the picture, and that's the sound, and you can just move it and you can run them singly, whichever you want to do. And right through the making of the film, these two are running side by side the whole time.
Wow.
So if they say we're going to have a viewing, you go into the projection box, that goes onto the projector, that goes onto the sound machine, and then the two turn.
Is that how they would be shown in the cinema then as well?
No, that's why you have the married print.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah. Because they would have a projector that had the sound that much out of sync with you. Yeah, there's, I think it's 24 frames.
I don't know whether you know, in the last year, because to celebrate 60 years of Bond, they showed all the films in order at the cinema, and I think they'd converted them, haven't they, before then to digital.
Ah.
But I must say that the early ones were very well restored.
The early ones.
Really, the picture was fantastic. Okay. Because we've only seen them growing up on video or whatever, where the sound and all that was okay. Seeing them on the big screen, because, you know, obviously we were too young, seeing Dr. No and Jamaica and all that.
Remastering.
It was just like watching a new film. Oh, you know, listening to a new film as well. It was fantastic. And it made you think, gosh, this must have been the impact in the 60s. This must have been what people were seeing.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And opening you up to this new world of that people were escapism, isn't it?
Very much so. Yeah. Yes. Some people have told me that they've altered the sound on one or two of them.
Yeah, well, Thunderball, John, that was much better, wasn't it?
So Thunderball, my Blu-ray copy, the mixing levels between the dialogue and the score are very uneven. So I have to turn it up when someone's talking and turn it down when the score's
on. Oh, really?
It's how it's come out on the Blu-ray. But at the cinema and the remastering, they've evened it out perfectly now.
Oh, well,
makes such a difference.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Because it is frustrating, and it takes it away a bit when you've got that drop in level.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah.
I just wanted to say to Really 007 podcast, my name's John Richardson. I've done a few effects in my life. Listen to the podcast and enjoy it.
Right, this is how editing rooms looked for all over the making of films. I would think up to about 16 or 17 Bonds from the 30s. That's what a cutting room looked like.
Look at that. And this big machine that you're using, what's that called?
That's the Moviola.
Moviola, right, yeah.
Yes.
Goodness.
On the continent, they had a different machine. I'm just trying to think what it was called. And now, with digital, that's all they have is three screens. So the great thing about where their advantage is that if they make a cut and they think, oh, made that a bit too this or a bit too that, they just reprogram it. Whereas here, you've made a major error and you've got to either put a piece back in or take a piece back out. Yeah.
Fantastic. We've mentioned a few of the directors. How much involvement did you have with them, like Terence Young, Guy Hamilton and Lewis Gilbert?
I never became that close, except that when all the films were over, Guy Hamilton and I used to meet at various functions.
Right, yes.
And I think, you know, without not being boastful or anything, I think the Oscar had something to do
with it. Yeah.
I think he felt very proud that that was his film and not somebody else's. And we became sort of quite close, and we always used to single each other out and sit together and stuff.
Aww.
At one point, a guy called Anders Freyr, who seems...
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah, we know. Yeah, we do, yeah.
He got to know Guy. Guy moved, I think, to an island. I'm not sure if it was Isle of Man or or it may have been Mallorca. Mallorca, I think it was. And we had it all worked out that he and I were going to go there and join him for either for his birthday or some function. And to my disappointment, the poor man passed away.
Oh, right. Oh,
I was really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Oh, that's sad, isn't it? Yeah.
But Terence, I mean, he knew me and I knew him,
but we
never really had much chance to talk or anything. It was always Peter and him.
Yeah. Like there's Dick Maybaum and all these people, John Steers.
Yes.
They're fantastic.
Because
he got an Oscar for Thunderball, John, I think.
He did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
After Bond, can you just tell us how it came to be that You Only Live Twice originally was your last Bond film, wasn't it? That you moved on from the world of Bond.
Yes, I moved on from the world of Bonds, yes. And finally achieved my ambition to become a film editor.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing about the first film I ever edited, which was called Joanna, was a swinging 60s film, and the director and the type of film meant that I didn't have to be too... I could be a little bit more unconventional in the way I put the film together, and I think it was noticed. I noticed that in the critics, two of them mentioned the editing, which I thought was rather
great.
That's
great, isn't it? Yeah.
And one thing led to another. In time, I worked on six different films as a film editor. One of them was in Egypt. It was in Israel.
Right.
One of them was in Germany.
Because you've worked with some amazing directors, haven't you? You've worked with Richard Donner, is that right?
Richard Donner, that's right.
What was he like?
Excellent. Yeah. I really enjoyed working with the guy. Yes, he was very appreciative, because what happened on that film was that he was given an editor, an elder editor, who actually was employed by the people that were making the film, if you know what I mean. I didn't quite understand it. But anyway, he obviously found that it just wasn't coming together in any way the way he had it in mind. And he was getting very concerned. The photographer on the film was also in that photograph.
Oh, yes.
He won an Oscar as well. And he was on Joanna. And he said to the director, I think there's a guy I know that would be right for you. And so they got in touch, and I was taken onto the film, and he was very pleased that finally it was going together the way he had in mind. And it was a good relationship. I was very pleased to work on it.
And which film was that?
Twinkie,
that's right. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. And Honor Blackman was in it.
Yes, she was. Yes. Yeah, in Twinkie. And Susan George, she and I got to know each other. Yeah.
Was it amazing to finally be there and editing films?
Yes. It wasn't just having the status of being more important to people and having a credit to myself and everything. it was the creative joy of putting a film together. And I think it was trying to think of the guy who said that the films were made in the editing department, which I thought was a bit extreme because you're only as good as the material that they've shot. But to some extent, I know what he meant. But you just feel so close to it and you feel so responsible for it. And I just love the actual job itself. It really, really appealed to me. I always knew it would. I always knew when I was an apprentice that was the job for me.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how you've gone all the way to do that. Yeah.
It's a great story.
You've worked on, was it Fahrenheit 451? Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. François Truffaut.
Yes, François Truffaut.
There's some amazing names you've worked with in your career.
Yes, I felt very proud to work with him.
Yeah.
I let myself down a bit, really, because even though I speak schoolboy French, I didn't get involved because I knew what would happen. If I started to use a bit of French, he was going to rattle away. I would be embarrassed. When he first arrived here, we were told that the only English he knew were the titles of all the English and American films he'd seen, loads and loads of them. So he remembered all the titles, but he couldn't speak a word of English. And so they said, when he first turned up, they said two or three of us, take him round the studio and show him all the different departments and all the rest of it. And every department we took him to, he said,
You'd done A Warm December, is that right? With Sidney Poitier?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was probably the happiest film of my career.
Oh, right. Wow. Oh, brilliant. Okay.
For the moment we got together, I don't know what it was, but somehow we bonded. And I liked the man so much. And not only that, but for some reason, we reached the point where every time there was a decision to be made, I was only the dialogue editor. I wasn't the editor and there was an American editor. But whenever there was a decision, he used to say, Norm, what do you think? Norm, what do you think? I used to think, this is amazing. This is Sidney Poitier watching my decision. I think I know what it was. There was a very young girl in the film. She was only about 13. And my responsibility was doing the post-synchronising.
Yeah.
And they said that she'd never done any before and that would I make sure that she understood exactly what was necessary and so on and not make her nervous. And while we were doing it, the American editor came in for some reason. I was aware that he'd come in and he was watching. And I was aware that he also walked out and didn't think any more about it. Pembroke, his name was, but we all called him Pem. And a couple of days later, I went into one of the viewing theatres for some reason, and there was no one in there. And he looked across and he said, Norm, come here. And I thought, what's all this about then? And when I got to him, he was about that much from my face, and he said, Pem says you're the best fucking sound colour that walks.
That's great, isn't it? Yeah.
Well
done, yeah.
Some of the funny sides of filmmaking.
Yeah. We have to mention Never Say Never Again. I didn't know until recently that you returned to Bond.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, I'd left the industry, but I hadn't been gone that long, but then the editor was American on that film, but his assistant was a friend of mine. And he rang me one day and he said, I said, oh, how's it all going? He said, well, he said, Sean's not really that happy. You know, he misses the old days when it was like a family and the same people on each film. He said, he's not really that content anymore. We wondered if you would consider coming back. And I said, well, I've never met Sean. He said, I know. He said, but he knows about you. And just to have someone back from the old days, I'm sure would be. And I said, well, you know, it's a big decision for me. And I spoke to my wife and she said, well, you've nothing to lose, really. You'll make a few bob. So anyway, I decided I would, especially as he was my friend.
Yeah.
But from then on, I don't think it was a very happy film at all. There was a guy who'd come from America that was dealing with the money side of it. And he there was something about him. He could eat very easily, split people. And I knew the people that were editing the film, but we were beginning to fall out. And I knew it was always this guy that was causing it. What really was surprising was when the film had finally been assembled and we all went into the theatre to see it, when it was finished, it went very quiet. And one of the writers said, OK, why did Bond go to the Bahamas?
What?
And we all said, yes. Why did he go? There was a fault in the script. There was no scene that explained why he had decided to go to the Bahamas.
Right.
That is fascinating.
Is that in the final edit?
That was in the, no, it wasn't the final edit.
Oh, right.
That was the first assembly. But right. The fact was, they didn't have, I mean, they stopped shooting, all the crew had gone and everything. I'm not sure how they got around that.
We'll have to watch it again to try and, I know what you mean when, is it just cuts to it and you don't know, why he's there?
I'm not sure if somebody spoke over someone's back or what.
Yeah, they do,
So did you ever get to meet Sean? Like, obviously, because you were coming back on as a face of familiarity, did they ever introduce you to him?
Well, all that happened was that we were outside my editing room and the editor was with Sean and he called me and there were the three of us standing there and I was aware of Sean sort of looking me up and down and I spoke with the editor for whatever it was he wanted to say. So then we split and to my amazement, Sean came into my room.
Aww.
And I think both of us thought that it was time to say, we've worked together on all these films and we've never been introduced, but it didn't actually sort of happen. I don't know why, it just didn't happen.
So you were there with him, but you just didn't
he came in
say.
And we were...
Yeah,
up,
yeah. Oh.
And I could tell he wanted to speak and chat, and I wanted to as well, but I don't know what happened there. It didn't.
Both suddenly very shy.
Right, yes.
Oh. Well, I'm sure he obviously...
But the fact that he came in meant something, you know, that he'd obviously heard about me and he wanted to get a little bit closer.
Yeah, he obviously appreciated all the work you'd done on his films. But
probably,
yeah. So that was the last film you did, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. I don't know really what they thought the point was of remaking a film so soon, underwater and, oh, God.
I think we prefer Thunderball, don't worry.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at all the chat between the Bond boys on Facebook, they never mention Never Say Never.
No.
Never mention it.
I think partly because it was a sort of, the rights issue and they tried to make a rival Bond film. Because it came out at the same time as Octopussy.
Yeah, you're right.
Which we love, that film.
Well, Octopussy is a brilliant film.
That was fair enough.
Yeah. So in terms of your
Bond...
Tragic,
really.
Yeah, well, yeah. Who's your favourite? I mean, I assume your favourite Bond is Sean, I'm assuming.
Yeah, like I would think 85% of the Bond fans.
Yeah, well, it's incredible, really, that even though it's a long time since he was Bond, young people growing up now still look back and think...
Yeah,
he's the original, wasn't he? So
yes,
it does help.
He was.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people that don't pick Sean, and I think probably it was because they grew up with a different Bond.
Correct.
And that to them was Bond. Yeah. I should think Roger's got loads of fans.
Oh, he does, yeah.
When you think how many he was in,
Yeah.
I thought Piers had a lot going for him.
Great. Oh, brilliant. Thank you. Because he's not got as much love as lately. It's nice to hear that you've appreciated.
Yeah, I respected the guy because you could believe him as being that kind of person in that film.
Yeah,
it's just that towards the later ones, he was looking a little bit on the old side. Yeah.
Well, Roger was as well, wasn't he? Yeah, yeah. And you've seen them all, haven't you? Up until No Time to Die.
Yes, all of them. And Quantum of Solace was an absolute disgrace. In fact, I did write to the makers.
And did you?
Yeah, I did. I said, this is absolutely incredible. That it had it been any other film but a Bond, that would have been put shelved and or recut or done something.
Yeah, yeah.
Never would it have been shown in that state.
My word, this is brilliant,
Norman. It was an amazing interview. Anyway, it's now the greatest interview. I couldn't agree more. But there we go. Sorry.
No, it is. It's famous because apparently it was all rushed, wasn't it? There was the writer's strike.
Yes. But there's no excuse.
No, it isn't. No, because you had a year between films, didn't you? Each one.
Yeah.
You had to get it all done with.
That's right.
With less money.
Yeah.
And more pressure, really. I mean, it is amazing, isn't it?
It really was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, to have a car chase at the start where you have no reason to have it. No, you're watching this car chase and you think, so what? A car chase is always after a scene that spurs it on.
Yep.
But no.
Absolutely.
What do you think Peter Hunt would have made?
And the cutting of the fights.
Yeah, right. It's a completely different style, isn't it?
Yes, because what's so serious about it is that the producer's job is not just to hire people, it's to have control over the movie. And they should have said, well, whoa, 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 you know, what's happening here? We don't cut fight scenes like that, because there's no tension in it at all. Mm. It's too fast. You don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
The tension in a fight is when you've got those moments when someone's, you know, held there and you're not sure which way it's going.
Yeah.
No, all chopped to ribbons. Unbelievable, really.
You're speaking to quite a lot of Bond fans who felt the same way, I think.
But for me to write to them,
and
I said it very gently. I said, I believe, I have been told, I've just come back from abroad, I've been told that certain journalists walked out of the preview, you know.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, they did.
Did you ever get a reply?
No.
Right.
No reply.
Well, what do you think Peter Hunt would have made of...
Oh, dear.
Oh, wow. But you were telling us that you went to the Spectre premiere, didn't you, a few years later?
Yes. Strange, really, because we were put very, very close to the screen. So one, it was in my face, The other was the sound. I could feel it all trembling at it.
Right.
My feet. And to me, it was just another film. I didn't come away thinking it was any more than just another Bond film. I began to think perhaps they were running out of ideas.
Well, What did you think about No Time to Die?
Oh, yeah. No, I couldn't understand quite what was going on there. Quite extraordinary. So much chat, so little action. I mean, you had some action at the start that was a bit outrageous, you know, screeching cars, doing silly things at a town. And then it all stops, and then it all becomes dialogue for so long.
Yeah.
And the villain doesn't arrive until three quarters of the way through the film.
Yeah.
Absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
Craig Kate is real.
Well, were you all right with Bond dying at the end? Was that okay?
I couldn't quite see what the point was, really. I thought, well, you must have had a reason for doing that. Mm. Have you any idea what you think their reason is?
I think it was Daniel Craig, his idea, wasn't it?
It may be the end of his Bonds, but it's not the end of the Bond sequence, is it?
Absolutely.
It'll come back, of course, and we're still looking forward to the next, who will be cast and what direction they go in.
Yes.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
I expect a lot of audience will expect some kind of scene to explain how he's come back.
I think as us Bond fans, they'll just pretend it didn't happen. But a lot of the general audience will be like, I thought he died. I think they will think he died. Yeah.
But Craig's first film is the finest of all the Bond films.
Right, good. Well, okay. I was going to ask, you do still like Daniel as Bond?
Yes, I think he was getting a little bit old for the part, but nevertheless, you know, he was right.
Good, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
But that first one, I always forget the title again.
Casino Royale.
Yeah, Casino Royale.
Yeah, very good film.
It was brilliantly directed, a very good script.
Yeah.
Had everything going for it, and a brand new Bond, I think it came just at the right time.
Yes.
The series was just beginning to get a little bit tiresome, I thought.
Yeah. It really benefited from having, obviously, an original Fleming material as well, didn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly.
Because when you first started, Ian Fleming was still alive, wasn't he?
Yes.
Did he ever? How often was he at Pinewood, and was he around?
There are lots of pictures with him. You know.
Yeah.
Someone like Graham Rye would be able to show you loads of pictures of him. You know, coming to the set and things like that. I never saw him, but that was something, wasn't it? To see his books being put into reality.
Because were you a fan of the books? Had you read any of them before you?
I hadn't actually. No. In fact, I haven't. I think I only read one.
Right. Which one? Can you remember which one that was?
No, I can't. No.
It wasn't Quantum of Solace short story, was it?
Oh dear. You do have an amazing legacy of Bond that very, very few can match. And I know you've moved on to lots of other things in your life. You know, we haven't talked about your second career, and you know, you're out here in the countryside now.
I still love film, though.
Film's really hard to see.
Yeah, I go to everything that's worth seeing, I go to see.
Yeah. Which is great. Just listening to some of the opinions on the latest Oscar contenders is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because you'll have a different sensitivity to it and a different way of looking. Well, we're going to ask, actually, when you see a film, how much can you... Are you always listening to the sound on it? specifically?
Not necessarily just the sound, but you do find for the first few minutes that you're analysing it. You're analysing the reality of the acting.
Yeah.
Whether the storyline is quite what you thought it was, and sound doesn't really come into it because usually it's dialogue, and my hearing, unfortunately, isn't what it used to be.
Okay.
And I struggle a bit, unfortunately, to hear. This upsets me when I go to the cinema. I'm always straining to hear what they're saying. Mm. But no, not generally.
You can sit back and enjoy the film, though.
Yes.
Yeah, you could. That's good. Yeah.
Well, that's the big thing. If I can sit back and enjoy the film, it means it's my kind of movie.
Yes, yeah.
But some films, because I'm at home, I don't watch television like most people do, but I do like films. And so I go on Netflix, try and find a title, put it on. Within 10 minutes, I think, no, off it goes.
Oh, right.
It's very, very rarely that I see one right through. I don't know why. They just don't seem to be me or my theme or my type.
Yeah, yeah.
Final question, Norm. Which Bond film that you've worked on are you most proud of?
Oh, the one I'm most proud of? I think it probably has to be Dr. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we can't disagree with that because it's just unbelievable. Yeah. It's so good. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, there was a lot in it, yeah. It's strange because if you've worked on a film, you can't really watch it because the whole thing is you were there when it was there. So, but years later, give Gareth his due, when it was the 50th anniversary, he had this event at Pinewood, and obviously he was going to show a Bond film, and he had the sense to say, well, the best thing is to show Dr. No, because that was the start of the whole 50. Yeah. Do you know, I sat back and I was able to be objective. Instead of analysing it, I just sat back. And do you know, I could see why it was a success.
Yeah.
I found myself getting quite tense in places. Yeah, I thought, no, come on. You know? And I thought that said it all. That proved to me why it was the success it was. Yeah. Very rarely you can do that. It was only because it was 50 years later.
It took that long to appreciate it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Brilliant.
Well, thank you very much, Norman.
Thank you so much.
I think I admire you all for being Bond fans, you know.
Yeah, well.
Taking the trouble to get involved in them.
We're in love with them, and I think we always will be.
You always will be.
I think it's partly because as children, we were brought up with them, and my dad was like Bond, and he saw them in the 60s, you know, at the cinema, and I think that love has continued through all of us. And
we'll
show our kids the Bond films and hope they like them as much as we do.
Yes, yes. And Roger's fine for you, is he?
Oh, yeah. We love them all. I know it's very different to how it started and all that, but I think for the audience at the time, it's what they wanted, isn't it?
Right. A bit of a difference. Fair enough, yes.
And I dare say they might go back to that more light-hearted now. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah, it would be sad if they did, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You never hear anyone say they should go back to the Sean. I don't think anyone would complain with that, would they?
I wouldn't have thought so.
No.
He just had a way of doing it. When he said, I think they were on their way to a funeral.
But that
look was so subtle.
Because he doesn't overact, does he?
No,
all restrained. No. And
oozes charisma and presence, doesn't he? Yeah.
And I always remember, I can't always remember which film it is, the film starts with him setting up that bomb in that building.
Oh, Goldfinger.
Oh. Well, I think it's Goldfinger, is it?
And then he goes to that bar or wherever it is.
Goldfinger.
In the white dinner jacket.
Oh, yeah.
And is he standing there when it explodes in the bar?
Yeah.
Now the look on his face.
That's...
None of the other Bonds would even begin to be able to have done that look.
I agree. Because you can't teach that, can you, really?
You can't, no.
It's that, and he lights his cigarette, doesn't he? And it's just
incredible.
So cool. He's
checking his watch, just like, it's brilliant.
That was me who did that, yeah.
I've never forgotten that look.
Oh, that's Bond, though, isn't it?
Bond.
That's what made Sean such a good Bond, really. Yeah.
It's the original.
Yeah.
He's not my personal favourite, but I will always say he's the best. I think he is the best James Bond.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, who's your favourite?
Timothy Dalton.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I love them all. I do.
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah, he never came over to me as a special agent for some reason, but...
Who, Dalton?
Dalton. No.
Cut this short. We don't want any slants. I'm only joking.
I was very surprised that Peter Hunt accepted, what's his name for...
George Lazenby.
in the history of films, I bet you cannot find one film where the star was someone who'd never acted.
Yeah, yeah. In such a pivotal film where you're coming after Sean Connery. Yeah.
I know. And it shows too.
David, do you want to take over?
Funny enough, I did meet him very briefly. Yeah. They used to have these events at Pinewood. I used to enjoy them, actually. Yeah. And they used to invite people that had worked on it and lots of fans so that they could have signed things and everything and the actresses. And he and I were on this table and my wife was very, very seriously ill.
Oh, right.
And someone must have mentioned it to him. And he and I, you know, looked across and did a bit of this and that. And then he passed me this bit of paper and he'd written on it, "Whatever happens is what was meant to be." And I thought, that's a very, very gentle way of putting it, really.
Oh, bless
and
him,
I said, well done, you know, and showed it to my wife.
Oh, bless her, yeah.
But he's tried to make a future for himself, but...
Yeah,
it's interesting to me that Peter never directed another one.
Yeah,
means something must have gone wrong.
But we think he was a brilliant director.
He's amazing,
as well as an editor. He was a brilliant director.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah,
but not another Bond.
Yeah,
you'd have thought he would have carried on the series.
We'd have loved more. Loved more.
I wonder what went wrong there.
Yeah.
But now, like 50 years later, it's seen as the pivotal Bond film. It's seen as the film that people aspire to remake and stuff.
Yeah, they really love
it. And it's the direction of it that is the big thing. Like,
well, Honor Majesty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people say it's the Bond film, don't they?
Yeah, they really do.
I know.
Yeah.
I feel bad because I think he died before it had fully come back. Everyone said it's a masterpiece before he died, after he died, you know, and... I don't know whether... I hope he knew that.
I hope he knew
how well thought of it was and how well he'd done on it.
I wonder how that happened.
Yeah, I don't.
But, you know, we've all got our own opinion and reaction, so you can't really keep commenting, really.
Yeah.
But obviously there had been certain common levels here.
Yes, yeah, of course. Thank you so much, Norman.
Yes.
Norman. We've loved it and it's been, an honour to meet you.
It really has.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.